mutual aid, active resistance, skill building, and knowledge sharing to table booths and propose workshops. This is an anarchist space, which means it opposes hierarchies and seeks to amplify unheard voices and build communities of mutual aid and support.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the CIT Archives show, the show where we do some digging and sleuthing to learn about the history of our beloved station here, located in the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam Nation at UBC. So I always like to say that this is a show about history, and a big part of it all is that history is never in the past, and we must always remain aware and remain critical of the systems that brought us here and where we are today. So wherever you're listening from, think of where you are and how you got here. So for the first time in a while, I'm actually joined by many people here. It's a full house. Welcome back, Michael, and welcome back, JT.
Hello.
To the show.
What's up?
Michael and I are sharing a mic today, so things are different. And we also have a very special guest here with us today. We're very excited for her to be here. She's done all kinds of things and appears in all kinds of ways within the history of CITR. I looked it up and your name appears 92 times, or in 92 different issues spanning from 1985 to 2014.
That's like 8.5 years. That's 8.5 years of issues. That's crazy.
Even more, 1985 to 20.
No, 92 issues.
If it's 92 more, different issues.
That's crazy.
Oh, you mean, oh, that's really quick maths. Anyways, Janice McKenzie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Beloved station, indeed. Yes. Yeah. It's like my spiritual home.
So we have many questions for you today. I guess we already kind of like got to know each other a bit before we started. But I guess I wanted to start from the very beginning for you. Like, what did the year is 1985, or like a bit before that? Like, take us back. What is happening? What is your situation here with UBC, CITR?
Right. So, first of all, listeners, whoever's out there, if there's anybody out there who doesn't actually remember that time period, because who knows who's listening, right? This is a time before streaming music. This is a time when the only way you could hear about good music was kind of like a drug deal almost. You had to know somebody. You had to kind of meet somebody in a parking lot. So people would lend you cassettes or lend you LPs, or you would take a really long bus ride to an independent record store to discover cool music. But the other thing that was happening was CITR, and it was this anarchic kind of place where students were allowed to be on air and play kind of whatever they wanted, as long as it wasn't on commercial radio. And commercial radio was really, really, really shitty. So it was like a beacon of cool music and cool people, cool, super stylish people as well. And so once I was I'd been listening for a long time before I was a student at UBC. And then I was a student here and I was living on campus and my friends were going to dances where CITR was spinning the records. And they did, I think, Thursday nights at the Pit Pub, all these things. So I just thought CITR was the absolute coolest, most unattainable place. And I one day got the nerve to go upstairs in the sub and down the hallway where CITR was. And I saw the sign and I started to walk down the hallway thinking, I'll just kind of see, like, I'm just going to walk by this incredibly cool place and just see what it looks like. And I was practically trembling. And then this woman came jumping out and said, can I help you? Are you interested in getting involved? And it was the station manager at the time. Her name was Candace Kerr. Yeah. And I said, oh, no, I'm fine. Or, you know, maybe you guys need some help with opening mail or I don't know, something, filing, because I had no skills. And she said, she stared at me and she said, you have a good voice. Maybe you should be on the air. And we need more women on the air. And as I soon found out, there were very, very few women who were hosting shows. If they were on the air, they were maybe helping out with a show. And I think it was probably about, there was one point when I did I was helping to maintain the programming grid, and I think it was about 10% of the programmers, four out of about 40, maybe four out of about 45 who were women. So it really was a problem at the time. It was mostly dudes, almost entirely white dudes who were on the air, and we needed to change that. It took a long time, and it took a lot of determination, but we did eventually end up with a lot more women on the air. That's that story. It did take me a long time to develop the skills to be on air because it is quite technical, as you know, and it was more complicated than before computers. We ran reel-to-reel tape recorders and things like that. The board just looked a bit more primitive and it was more fussy and things broke more often. I'm sure it's just as hard now. I don't know why.
It's not quite that
no,
hard.
It's not quite that
hard. I don't think so.
I did one show on my own and I'm like, yep, this is, I can do this.
Oh, okay.
I was intimidated by it at first, but then you kind of,
The technical training used to take quite a while.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had to prove that you could be on air by not playing bad music or not playing commercial music or something like that. And then you had to wait for a slot to open up. So it was a bit of a journey to get on air.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask about that because, like, before we came on air, you said it was way more strict and way more, also more competitive as well to get a show. Could you tell us a bit more about what that was like?
Yeah, I was just assuming it's the same now, but you would have to apply to get a show. You would have to I don't remember the terminology now. If there's any old pals listening, they're probably yelling at the radio, but I think you had to do sort of recordings of shows, right? You still have to do that.
You still have to do that. JT is nodding.
Yeah. And there were just a lot of people who wanted every slot. So it could take a long time and it could be hard. I remember I had to try a few times. It was like getting a driver's license and having a really tough examiner.
That's nice.
So you said that you majored in CITR, but when you were not majoring in CITR, what were your studies like here at UBC?
Yeah, as an undergrad, I took kind of a broad mixture of things. But I ended up getting a bachelor's degree in creative writing and then going on to get an MFA in creative writing. And then I had to get out of here for a while. I managed to pull myself away, which was not easy. But then when I came back to do a master's in library studies, which was in the 90s, I kind of had almost the mirror experience where I thought, should I walk by that hallway again? I know what's going to happen if I walk by that hallway. I'll get sucked into the vortex. And then I thought, oh, but I could say hi. And it just so happened that I actually still knew a couple of people there, and they were really welcoming. Linda Scholten was the station manager at the time. She was the station manager for a long time. And they were really welcoming, and they almost immediately said, we still need women on the air, and we still need people to write local music reviews, which was another thing I'd been doing at Discorder. Mm-hmm. So I did immediately fall back into the vortex, and I stayed again until I was like 8.5 months pregnant with my daughter and just couldn't physically do it anymore in 2002.
Oh, that's nice.
And you had several different shows, right? So there was Rude Awakening.
That was my first one.
First one. Where the Action Is was another one that I spotted in Discorder magazine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So... and then later on in the 90s, I did one called Girl Food. And the funny thing is, I don't think I ever named any of my own shows. Somebody else always came up with the names. Mm-hmm. Where the Action Is, I have a lot of regret about that. Peter Cordemache was the producer, and it was his idea, and it was such a good idea. His idea was to bring in local record collectors, people who had really amazing record collections, and I just was not, I was not well, and for me to interview them, for me to interview them. And I loved it. It was really interesting, but it was also really hard work, and I wasn't really the right person to do it. I think it would have been great if Peter had done it. Mm-hmm. But I did it probably for only about a month, interviewing these really, really interesting, like, record store owners and other people. And that is a regret I had. I should have probably tried to stick with it. That would have been really interesting.
You could. Come
I
back
could do it again.
You can do it again.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And sometimes I really miss being on the radio. Maybe I will.
Yeah. Sure. And then there was Vinyl Disasters. That was a different one that I spotted.
Okay. I don't remember them all, honestly. Was that maybe that was an evening one that I did after the The Rude Awakening obviously was a morning show, and that was kind of an unbelievable thing to do for your first show because it was 3.5 hours long from 7 to 10:30. And I was living in Gage Towers. Sorry. I was living in Gage Towers, thank goodness, because I just had to stagger across the parking lot to get here. But
did you pick that time slot? Sorry.
No.
Oh, okay.
I was like, who would willingly do that? That happened to be what was available, I guess. I can't imagine why it was available. So, of course, I said yes. And because the only kind of music I liked was basically three-minute songs. There were some like sort of documentary type things that we would play. Usually they would be on a reel-to-reel. So there was sort of like the equivalent of playing an NPR piece or something now. But other than that, it was just completely insane. And I would just play all sorts of things I'd never heard just based on the cover. Sometimes it worked out really well. That's how I discovered some of my favorite bands. But sometimes it was a disaster, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of your favorite bands, I think if I remember correctly, you said that your favorite garage rock band from the time was The Sonics.
The Sonics.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was this big re-release in around that time called Sonics Boom, I think.
Yeah.
I think I have it with me. They were a Seattle band. And so to me, when the 90s came around and people were talking about the Seattle sound, and it was Nirvana, of course, we were all thinking of, or a lot of us were thinking of, that really early garage kind of sound, like Louie and the Sonics. Mm-hmm. And I love the Sonics.
I was like listening to it the other day. The guitar playing is insane.
Super cool.
It's like kind of bluesy, but also very alternative as well. I really liked, like, I don't know who the guitar players, but their lead playing was just phenomenal.
I'll pull out the LP and we can look at the back at all the credits. No, they were technically really amazing.
Yeah.
And I actually saw them play. They did some kind of a reunion tour with, I believe, the original lineup about 10 years ago, and they were fantastic.
Yeah.
They must have been in their 70s, but they were amazing.
Were they still did they still have that energy to them?
Yes. Really? And the singer still had the scream.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, because that's the thing. You associate garage rock with, you wouldn't think they'd be that technically strong. Like, that was the thing that I was, completely floored by. Like, the guy's guitar playing, his chops were, if you put his chops on, a 70s, hard rock or, a prog rock album, that guy would fit right in.
Are you going to play them? Do you have it queued up?
I hope so.
Yeah. What song do you think you'll play?
Well, we saw that the first song that you ever learned how to play
was Strychnine.
Yeah.
That's because I couldn't play an A bar chord. I can only play E bar chords.
The A bar chord, the flat one?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So I was in England just before the pandemic, and there was an insurance ad that kept playing all the time that we used Have Love Will Travel, which is just the Sonics version, which just astonished me. It's so good. Anything from them is fantastic. And actually, there was an early Vancouver punk new wave band, the Pointed Sticks, that used to cover them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a lot of Vancouver bands really liked them.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it in your
your blog post.
Your fantastic blog, janicemckenzie.ca. So I've been waking up at 4 a.m. and I had a viewing at 12. So from 6 to 11, I was just doing work for the episode on Monday or Sunday when I sent it to you.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I read a lot of them. The one that you had a story arc, the concussion recovery one.
Oh
my goodness. I was this is an HBO miniseries. Yeah. This is incredible.
Aw.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have lots to talk about don't we? But we also should play some music, right?
I also love
this
that.
This is CITR.
Yeah, we can listen to the Sonics in a bit. I also loved how you kind of compare being a librarian and being so precise and obsessed with accuracy and perfection, and then that against loving music and letting your hair loose and dancing around. And it reminded me of Party Girl. Have you ever watched that movie?
I love Party
Girl. You're a party girl. It's basically Parker Posey, and she plays this young woman who becomes a librarian, but she's a super party girl, right? And then in the end of the movie, the stars align when she organizes her friend's, her DJ friend's record collection by the, like, with the Dewey Decimal System. So it's like, oh my, like, it's like a full circle moment. It's beautiful.
Who directed it?
Oh, I forgot it. But I think you'd really like it.
You think I like it? All right, let's get to it.
Let's listen to Strychnine by the Sonics. Is that how you pronounce
Strychnine,
it?
Yeah. Strychnine, yeah. It's rat poison.
Oh. Okay.
Want to advertise with CITR Radio and Discorder Magazine? Well, good news, you can. Our copies of Discorder Magazine span 6,000 square kilometers and reach 3 million inhabitants across 32 locations here in Vancouver. Advertising with Discorder Magazine means being seen from UBC to New Westminster. Along with print, we offer advertising online, offering you a viewership to over 100,000 engaging with our content. From radio ads to Discorder Magazine and our online presence, CITR and Discorder Magazine knows how to get you seen. Contact sponsorship at CITR.ca to get advertising today. Sponsorship at CITR.ca.
On Home and Haunting deals with the uncertainty of memory as a mode by which artists conceive and construct their films. Using the language of hauntology, which deals with the ways social, cultural, and political issues from the past haunt the present, and how it connects us to the unresolved state of capitalist violence across time and embedded into history, this program highlights three artists working within this realm of the indelible: Han Pham, Adam Garnett Jones, and Luis Andres Serrano. The works of these artists are ghostly. They inhabit places of the past only possible from the present. And film is a medium favorable for these hauntings. From August 11th to September 3rd, 2025, the Belkin's outdoor screen will show On Home and Haunting daily between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m., a selection of films curated by Ogeneo Fegor Obuoma. You can also join Obuoma and filmmakers Han Pham and Luis Andres Serrano at the Belkin Gallery on Thursday, August 14th at 6 p.m. for a conversation about their work. To find out more, visit belkin.ubc.ca. That's belkin.ubc.ca.
If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault, you are not alone. Stand Informed Legal Advice Services is a new program offered by Community Legal Assistance Society that provides free legal advice to anyone who lives in BC and has experienced sexual assault in this province. Stand Informed offers up to 3 hours of free, confidential legal advice, regardless of age, gender, income, whether the assault has been reported to the police, or if you are uncertain that what you experienced is sexual assault. To access Stand Informed services, call 604-673-3143 or email standinformed@clasbc.net.
What do you love, and what do you love about it? My name is Ewan, and with I Love You Hour, I want to know. Come join me bi-weekly Tuesdays at 6 p.m. to discuss music and the stories we connect to it, either in person, on the phone, or through messages at I Love You Hour on Instagram. That's ILUVU Hour on Instagram, or through email at iluvhour@gmail.com. If you love sharing music and telling stories, listen to I Love You Hour bi-weekly at CITR 101.9. And remember, I love you.
Randophobic is best thought of as an introversal jukebox which has no concept of genre, style, political boundaries, or even space-time relevance. But it does know good sounds from bad. Lately, the program has been focused on Philip Random's All Vinyl Countdown plus Apocalypse, the 1111th greatest records you probably haven't heard. And we're not afraid of noise. Randophobic, every Saturday at 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
I know some of them.
Hello, we're back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is the CIT Archive Show, the show where we look at the history of our beloved station. Today, we are joined by many people here in the studio. Our special guest is Janice McKenzie, musician, writer, librarian. She does everything, basically. And we were just talking about music and a lot of Janice's influences and inspirations. And I guess we should segue onto your many music projects. How did you get started? I guess take us back.
So CITR has always been a place where musicians can connect and meet each other. There have been so many local bands have started because of CITR, people meeting each other at the station. And so I was over the moon excited about being a DJ here, being a programmer and having my own show. I couldn't even believe that was happening. And then a friend of mine at the station, Garnet Harry, was decided to throw together. We had a rougher version of a name for this kind of band, but a joke band, and it was going to be called Lou Cooper, Alice Reed, and the Commotions, and he was going to do Lou Reed and Alice Cooper covers, and so
That's awesome. So
he basically pulled some. There were people in at the station who were in various other bands, so he pulled a few of these people together to form a band, and as part of that, he pulled a few of the women at the station to be backup singers. And because I had a really good vintage dress collection, I got invited to be a backup singer. So, and of course I was thinking, well, I can't sing. I have no whatever, I'll just stand there in my dress. Well, something happened, and then another one of the backup singers and I, who was another DJ here, her name was Julia, she and I decided, wait a second, we're going to keep doing this. We're going to start another band. So we started a band called the Psycho Bunnies, which was made up of a guy, the bass player from the Bill of Rights, which was a super punk rock, hardcore punk rock band, and the guitarist from a band called the Belgianiques, and a drummer from Bill of Rights, Stu Temple. Anyway, so we started a band, and we played a few times, and we played like CITR parties and actual gigs and things like that. And then that was my first band. And I played guitar, even though I couldn't really play guitar. My boyfriend at the time lent me his SG. Yeah. Anyway, so that's what you could do in those days.
Like old Gibson SG? Like from like
it was
the
a 1962 80s? Gibson SG.
Oh my god.
That had originally belonged to Brad Kent, who had gone off and joined the I knew I was gonna draw a blank. He had left Vancouver and gone down to play with Penelope Houston or something. Anyway, super punk rock guitar. And so I didn't even have my own gear. I didn't know how to play. But in those days, you could just kind of start a band, and there were so many venues, and you could get opening slots. And because we were quickly writing our own songs. And in fact, one of those songs called I Like My Car Better Than You, which I wrote with the guitarist, the Touch and Goes used to play for years and years and years, and I still play it at my birthday parties. Oh. So that song lives on.
I like the idea that your birthday parties are just like concerts for you. That's like the image I'm having in my head right now.
Kind of, yeah.
You just show up like Prince, fireworks come out everywhere. Your name is like in
me.
Bright light.
Me. I love me.
I love me. And then you just like shred a guitar. Because you know how Prince has like that guitar with like his symbol?
Yeah.
And you have a guitar that's shaped Janus. That would be just like Janis.
Oh,
that's
like
the body.
Like,
yeah.
Michael.
He has a very big imagination.
Yeah, I think so.
Very vivid imagination.
It's not quite that interesting. But anyway, that was my first band, the Psycho Bunnies.
The Psycho Bunnies.
Yeah, and then eventually it went on to be in a band called The Touch and Goes, where I was the singer and the main songwriter. And we had a female bass player and then two guys. So that was our lineup. And we recorded our first recording down in Seattle, the Seattle Sound. Again, this is before Nirvana and all that, at a place called, I knew I was going to forget the name of the studio. Anyway, with it ended up being John Auer of the Posies, who ended up being the producer. But I went down there because the Fastbacks had recorded there and the Young Fresh Fellows, who were a couple of my very favorite bands. And we recorded the whole album in a weekend, which was the very kind of post-punk, punk kind of way to do things. And I think it came out really well. I think that's one of the albums that's on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those who don't know, the Touch and Goes have all their music on Bandcamp.
So some of it, anyway.
Check it out.
A bit of it.
Are we
going
to
hear
some of it?
Wait, so how many recordings are not on
there? I think there are a couple more that I haven't been able to track down the masters yet.
Should we listen to I Like My Car Better Than You?
Yeah.
What do you want to listen to?
What do
Michael?
I want to listen? Okay,
Michael
I want to listen to.
Hear
I want to listen
in
to
your
In Your
Pocket,
but we can listen to I Like Your Car Better Than You as well.
We can listen to.
Let's listen to both.
We can listen to. We can do an album listening party right now.
Right now. You want matter of fact? Let's take up the next show. Screw it. Let's take up the next show.
I don't care how you feel.
So you just listened to In Your Pocket by The Touch and Goes.
Oopsie. Almost heard another one. That was another one from the Psycho Bunnies era, actually starting there.
Okay. Amazing Stories?
Yep. Oh. Don't play that one though, okay? As the bass player used to say, that song was always a train wreck.
Who did you write Christopher about?
Nobody. But just the general campus radio type boy.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I was wondering if that was the inspiration.
Next episode.
Yeah. Debugging Christopher.
We also had a song, Campus Radio Boy, that charted here. So, and they were both similar kind of things.
Was it also part of the Touch and Goes? Or?
Songs by the Touch and Goes, yeah.
And Violet. Your other project, how did that come to be?
So after our bass player in the Touch and Goes moved away, we tried to keep the band going for a little while, but it never was quite the same. So the guitar player and I continued with something called Violet, which was just me writing all my own songs. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like a solo project plus a real guitarist, because that was not me, a real guitarist. I just hacked away a little bit. And yeah, it was actually, it was pretty fun. We did some interesting shows and we sometimes played with a full band as well. I mean, we could play with two people and we sometimes played with a full band. And I still play a couple of those songs. One Lynn Valley ballad I still play. Still played it like a couple weeks ago for some people.
Oh, for some people, like, was this like an event or?
Yeah, it was just a party.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool. Oh,
nice. Yeah. That's my murder ballad and it's always the most popular one. Yeah.
Should we listen to I Step on All the Cracks?
Should.
Sure, yeah. That one did. That one got played at CITR back in the old days.
That's awesome.
I think it got reviewed in Discorder too, right?
What? We gotta find out.
Cheating and undead.
Hello. We're back. You just listened to I Step in All the Cracks by Violet, one of Janice's many musical projects. And...
Sorry. See, one thing I really love about campus radio is that it's like we have conversations, we have microphones. It's like you can hear the mic squeaking, you can hear the headphones not falling off. Like some things never change. It makes me feel so at home
and very happy.
I love that you're saying these because I was just going to bring up that blog post that you did on finding old junk from a long time ago, like old projects.
Yeah.
And I love what you say about campus radio. You say, for sheer musical variety, nothing can beat campus or community radio. And you can find these low water stations in almost any reasonably sized city and aren't masterminded by professional, read commercially minded programmers and music directors, which is, depending on your point of view, either the best or worst thing about them. And we can all agree, I think, that it is the best thing about them.
I remember people complaining to us at the station that, you know, why don't you guys play good music? Or, you know, they would hate, or why can't I just tune in and know what I'm going to hear, right? Mm-hmm. Why can't I just put the dial on to the station and just listen all day to my favorite music? And that's never been campus radio. Well, I shouldn't say never, because probably in the 70s it was, but from the 80s it wasn't. The idea was that everybody programs their own show and that you need to have massive diversity on the air. So, yeah, you can hear your favorite kind of music and then 15 minutes later hear something that just makes you throw your radio across the room, like the worst possible thing that you hate the most. So, but that's the excitement. So the way back in the pre-streaming days, the way that we used to talk about that is it's a bit more like watching TV than the radio. It's like you have to kind of plan the times that you listen to your show. So yeah, people, you'd start your show sometimes and people would phone up and tell you how much they hated what you were playing because they liked what was happening just before. Or the opposite, right? Where thank God you came on because I hated the thing that was happening before.
It still happens today, guys.
What? Do you guys, is it?
I don't. Is there even a phone in here?
Yeah, now? Yeah. You can phone. We phoned in once for an interview, but we've never gotten people any calls or anything.
Yeah.
But does it happen to people?
Oh, people love Corey's show. So a lot of people tune in.
Which show is that?
5 p.m. is Pacific Noise Weird. Okay. And so there's like a big step up in tune-ins right at that time. So
shout out Cora.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you like that kind of show, then you love it. And if you hate that kind of show, then you hate it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, people aren't usually lukewarm on campus radio type shows.
Yeah.
It's not background music like commercial radio. Not it's stuff all. People care about.
Yeah.
It's actually really good training for things like public speaking and other high stress things in real life. It's like, totally. I'm used to people hating me. It's fine.
Yeah.
After you've played in bands and done radio shows, like, lots of people aren't going to like
completely
me.
Completely desensitized.
Yes, exactly.
I can't imagine, though. Can you imagine, like, someone calls in and is like, this episode sucks.
Do better.
The phone used to ring all the time.
I think it's now emails and messages on Instagram and DMs on Discord.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very There's so many ways to reach people.
Different ways.
Yeah, the phone would be, like, so the phone would automatically, the volume would switch off when you were on air. So it would just be like the light flashing constantly. And you'd pick up and it would just be annoying people making requests for things that you would never play on your show and arguing with you about it or telling you your show is terrible. It was pretty annoying.
It would happen live? Like whoever was tuned in, they would hear you getting roasted or...
Well, I mean, you would pick up when you weren't on air.
Okay.
You wouldn't pick up when you were on air.
So
you'd pick up on while you were playing records.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. It was, there was no other way to reach us. And sometimes people were, anyway, that's just another old programming story. When you talk to other programmers of old, they'll have stories like that too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I didn't want to ask, though, because I believe JT... I feel like we should talk a bit more about what you do now with, like, your library work and archives, because JT mentioned that you were
quite big with getting things into the open collection.
That's how. Oh yeah,
Well,
you were a catalyst.
That's a few different questions.
Yeah.
Well, you both knew each other from the library world before we kind of got here. Before I reached out to Janice, and Janice commented on the.
A mutual friend introduced us by email. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so there were two questions there. One is that Janice helped to get Discorder into the UBC Open Collection.
Yes.
And then I think the other thing was that you had been considering asking a question about librarianship overalls, which are two separate questions.
So maybe we can just talk about the digitizing thing for just a minute.
Let's talk about that one.
So I was the board chair, and I always forget exactly what years. I think it was 2008 to 2014, something like that. And Brenda Gruno was the station manager, and what an amazing person she is. She almost everything about the station that you love is probably thanks to Brenda. She and I were talking, and probably because I was a librarian, it kind of occurred to me that our special collections or an archives on campus might be interested in digitizing Discorder. And so she's the one who made it all happen. But I think the original idea might have been from me, but she is the one who did all the work to make it happen. So huge shout out to Brenda, who now works for the City of Vancouver and I'm sure is doing equally amazing things there.
Brenda, you're my hero.
If you can get Brenda to come on, she's very, very accomplished and amazing person. So that was really the digitizing thing. Because I worked in libraries and because I had actually worked either with or as part of special collections a little bit, I knew a little bit about digitizing projects and what they might be like and what kinds of things they might be interested in. So that's why that happened. Mm-hmm. And it's... So actually, I'll go a little sideways maybe.
Yeah.
JT also connected me with a panel that happened in the spring at 604 Records talking about the 90s music scene.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went and talked to them there. And one of the things about writing for Discorder in olden times and being on the radio is that you knew for sure that almost nobody was reading Discorder and almost nobody was listening to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you did would never be seen or heard again. So one of the things about this panel was they literally had a projector and they had my old columns on the wall, like floor to ceiling.
Amazing.
Oh, they did do it. Okay.
Yeah. Did they tell you they were going to do
they
that?
They talked about it.
So it was quite surreal to watch, to be in a room and be answering questions and things and see your own writing that you did when you were basically a teenager that you never expected anybody to ever read on a wall decades later.
I can't imagine. Yeah.
And I saw particular lines that I remember getting in trouble at, like things that caused problems at the time. So that was kind of surreal. Anyway, we did not expect that any of this stuff. We thought it was ephemeral. We thought it was just going to disappear. We did not expect it to still be around years later.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And I guess what got you into like library studies at first? What made you want to pursue that?
I think like a lot of there are quite a few of us who work in libraries who had romantic notions about libraries when we were young, you know, the stereotypes about being big readers, being, you know, kind of lonely kids who read a lot or very nerdy or whatever. I actually worked part-time as a library assistant for a long time as an undergrad at the Vancouver Public Library, the old location at Burrard and Robson. And then at some point, especially when my... all my bands and writing and all of my other stuff, I started to realize I needed an actual career, a profession. I started to notice that the librarians, the people who had a master's degree in library studies that I was working with, were actually super interesting people. And also they were very passionate about what nobody called social justice at the time, but we might call now, is they really cared a lot about intellectual freedom and access to information and education for all and diversity in the kind of information that was available. And a lot of equity concepts, things like that. And once I realized that that's really what was underpinning libraries, I got pretty excited about it too. So I went back to school.
That's awesome.
And I actually was a children's librarian for a while. I was a reference librarian in all sorts of different subject areas, mm-hmm. Including for a while, like music, film. I got to start the zines library at VPL. I was part of the group
that got to
do that.
Oh my gosh.
I was the graphic novels librarian for a while, and I would like go around to library conferences and explain like how to defend graphic novels from book banners and things like that. So I've had some really amazing jobs. And since 2008, I've been at Simon Fraser University, the other university on the other side of town. And I'm currently the user experience librarian, which I think is a really super cool, amazing job where I get to work with sort of the most things that people do with libraries now is online. And so trying to make that experience better for students and other researchers, which a lot of it's writing for the web. A lot of it's making sure interfaces work well. It's a great job.
When you talked to me about it, when we met first, it kind of seemed like you were orchestrating all the different people and departments who went into making the library website.
Well, yeah, we wrangle, I guess, a very, very large public website and a staff site as well. I mean, the thing about academic libraries and librarians, and I don't know if very many of our listeners will care, but people can decide what they want to put on the website. People have, mm-hmm. librarians have academic freedom like other faculty members do. And so I'm not telling other people what to do, but I'm trying to make sure that what we have on our website is usable and accessible, mm-hmm. and that it works and that it's findable. And then that I just feel like that's important.
It is.
The thing I personally love about the SFU Libraries website is that there's names connected to things mm-hmm. quite often.
Accountability.
Not only accountability, but like I can give people credit for when I find a good like finding aid and I like it and I want to say who made it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, we're kind of committed to that. That's good.
Oops, I'm getting too granular.
No, some of us could do a whole library show. That might be a whole other thing.
Yeah.
We could do one about guitars and one about libraries.
Actually, I think I found, was it like a Wilshire P90?
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
P90s,
yes.
Yeah.
P90s.
We're referring to the guitar on the cover art that Jenny's made for the violin EP.
Yeah, thank you. Different headstock, though, you notice. Mm.
And we're getting granular here.
Just a reminder that we should probably start winding down.
So, oh, and we still have a piece of vinyl we might play only if we have time. Yeah. Maybe part of it you could go
we
out on.
We can play part
it.
Of it, yeah. So Janice brought some vinyl with her, and this is a local band that you
enjoyed.
It's
a Vancouver band called The Enigmas, and they were really huge in the 80s. There were lineups. They used to busk downtown, but they also used to play at all the local clubs and were just massively big dance band, very popular. See what you think.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for tuning in. We leave you with a
Teenage Barnacle.
Teenage Barnacle. Oh, I love the sound in the beginning.
Thank you.